We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the author of Eating NAFTA, Trade, Food Policies, and the Destruction of Mexico. She is a professor of Latin American and Latino studies at City University of New York and an anthropologist by training. Alicia Galvez, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So obviously, our relationship with Mexico has been in the news. Trade has been in the news. Recently, Donald Trump, I guess, tentatively renegotiated NAFTA. Let's just start with the question of, like, why approach NAFTA and this relationship between Mexico and the United States from the perspective of food and eating?
Well, it's one of the ways that trade gets to us, really. It's one of the most direct ways that our lives are impacted by trade deals. Most of us are not, you know, dealing in, you know, chips or circuitry or car parts or airplane parts, but all of us eat. So it's one of the best ways that we have to kind of see how these things operate.
And so is that particular in terms of our relationship with Mexico? I mean, or is it particularly with our relationship with Mexico?
Yeah, it's not exclusive with Mexico, but there's no country that we have a closer relationship to in terms of our food systems. So we get, I live in New York City and, you know, much of the fresh fruit and vegetables that I eat comes from Mexico and a few other trading partners. We also get stuff, obviously, from Chile and from New Zealand and things like that. But there is a lot of the produce that gets consumed in the United States is coming from Mexico. And they're consuming a lot of our commodity grains. A lot of the corn and soy and wheat that gets produced in the United States is being consumed on the Mexican side in the form both of processed foods and beverages, but also animal feed, which is contributing to a, you know, a large growth in terms of the market for meat.
So, all right. So let's go back and give us a little bit of the sort of the pre-NAFTA history, I guess. And and then we'll go into NAFTA because that dynamic of this exchange of food is, largely a function of NAFTA in many respects.
Right. Well, NAFTA is really a product of the thinking of a few, mainly University of Chicago educated economists who were operating in all three countries. So Mexico's economic policymakers typically have studied in the University of Chicago, as have U.S. policymakers and Canadian as well, I assume. And we have a Milton Friedman, you know, motivated orientation towards the free market, towards taking down barriers to trade in the interest of the expansion of capitalism, that, you know, really comes to dominate thinking about economic development and economic policy in the 20th century. And that thinking, you know, basically prefers foreign direct investment, taking away any sort of barriers to cross-border trade, getting rid of tariffs and subsidies and things like that, so that capital and goods can flow freely across borders. That sort of thinking was so dominant that, you know, Margaret Thatcher famously said at one point, there is no alternative. You know, this is kind of the economic model that Reagan Thatcherism produced. And we see it, you know, turning into very concrete policy proposals. So NAFTA is one of those policy proposals, and the idea is to sort of knit together the three countries of North America into a single economic market. Unlike, you know, other examples we can think of, like the European Community that took away barriers to the circulation of people, we never really had a serious conversation about taking away barriers to people. But we did try to take away barriers to goods and capital to try to create a single unified market. And that was where NAFTA came from.
You know, and we should say this was a longtime libertarian a policy agenda in many respects. This internationalism, this is, you know, one of the things I think that came out of Mont Pelerin was this notion of bringing down these barriers to capital and on some level sort of fighting against the sovereignty of nations, at least in this respect. Right. It's and I think actually we interviewed someone about it. We're looking for the name right now. But this was a long term agenda. And in many respects, NAFTA was it wasn't the culmination. It was one of the culminations, I guess. And so,
absolutely.
So this, all right. So this dynamic, I mean, this is really fundamentally the issue, isn't it? Or is it that there is a disequilibrium in terms of what can cross borders easily and what can't, or who can't?
Yeah. Well, there are a few problems, and maybe because I'm not an economist, maybe because I'm an anthropologist, I'm able to see some of those problems in ways that they're visible perhaps to me in ways that they aren't to other disciplines, because there are some sort of taken for granted mantras within this sort of thinking that I find a little bit hard to understand and hard to believe. So one of them is the idea that what NAFTA is free trade. And if we, you know, kind of look at what free trade is supposed to be, it's supposed to be getting rid of barriers to trade, getting rid of subsidies, anything that kind of artificially gets in the way of the market doing its thing. But if we look at NAFTA, NAFTA was never a free trade agreement in spite of its name. The United States never got rid of its subsidies. We still famously, you know, pay farmers to grow corn, whether we need corn or not, to grow wheat, to grow commodity soybeans, et cetera. And so we have a market that's already not a free, you know, marketplace where supply and demand are determining everything. So that's one thing. Another idea that's very sacred in this sort of thinking is the idea of comparative advantage. And this is the idea that, you know, if one place is good at something, they should do all of that thing and other places. So if the U.S. is good at corn, the U.S. should produce all the corn for everybody who wants corn, and nobody else should bother because they can't do it as well as the United States can. And so maybe Mexico can build airplanes and work on car parts and leave the corn growing to the U.S. This is a very central idea to NAFTA, and it's part of the reason why NAFTA is such a problem for public health and Mexican culture and for the health of people in the United States as well. Because basically, not all corn is the same. The commodity corn that we grow in Iowa is not edible. It's not sustainable in the same way that heirloom corn, landrace corn is in small-scale farming in Mexico. It can't be eaten the same way. It can't be used the same way. It doesn't have the same symbolic or cultural value. So there's this idea of sort of equivalence that gets constructed that's really not not very logical or coherent. Then related to that,
Okay, well, you know what? I mean, I want to just flag that because I want to return to that dynamic. I think it's really important to talk about. But continue, and we'll come back around to that.
Yeah, no, just related to that, and this may be what you're thinking about, is the idea of efficiency. And again, you know, I'm not an economist, but my understanding of efficiency is that it's a ratio. It's, you know, you look at what you put in and you look at what you get out. And if you get a lot out for what you put in, then something is, you know, it's a pretty good deal. It's a pretty good effort. And when we look at corn, you know, part of the logic for the United States growing everybody's corn is the idea that the U.S. is more efficient at growing corn, and that Mexican small-scale subsistence farming is inefficient. But again, if we think about the ratio, we have to think about what's going in and what's coming out. And to get the incredibly massive yields per hectare that we get in U.S. commodity corn, we have to look at all of the inputs. We have to look at the patented corn the seeds. We have to look at the chemicals. We have to look at Roundup that's being sprayed on the crops. We have to look at the million-dollar tractors. We have to look at the administrative wings of most farm operations where they're, you know, applying for and administering the subsidies that are coming from the federal government. If we look at small-scale subsistence farming, oftentimes the plots of land are so small and irregular that you can't even have a tractor. It makes no sense to have a tractor. They might be rain-fed or they might be irrigated partially. The seeds are saved from one year to the next, so nobody is, you know, making a profit. Seeds are not intellectual property. Very few chemicals are often used. And so we see, you know, yes, very small yields, but there's very little that's going into that production. And in fact, it's damaging the environment far less than, you know, the much more chemically intensive production.
All right. Well, so I want to go back. Let's just go back over that. I want to talk first, just to go back to the idea of free trade, and that I will say that, you know, there are economists who make the point. Dean Baker comes to mind, who says, like, these aren't free trade. I mean, we hear that, you know, and whether it's TPP or this, it's not really free trade. It's just a word that's associated with it, and it sounds good. But, I mean, and you're not an economist. But, are there examples even of free trade? I mean, I guess maybe within the context of the European Union, within the context of it. You see free trade there, but I mean, we don't.
But they're also
maybe
taking
not even
into
there.
Consideration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go
yeah,
ahead.
I can't point to any. I can't point to any because, I mean, it can lead to some, you know, cruelties. There are harsh aspects to the market. You can have people plant and earn nothing, and you can have people, you know, grow more than the market wants and go bankrupt. You know, there's a lot of unpredictable factors. You know, I'm not an expert in this, but, you know, part of the reason we have subsidies is to try to smooth those things over. But what we end up having is a very hybrid system that's protecting some. The interests of some are being protected and some are being insulated from exposure to risk, while others are bearing all the risk. And that's the point of my book, really, is that, you know, there are, you know, the little guy in all three countries is bearing more of the risk. You know, this rhetoric about Mexico winning and the U.S. losing is a false rhetoric because it's working people in all three countries that are losing. It's people who are vulnerable to the vagaries of the market, who, you know, have feast or famine situations in terms of the jobs available to them. And, you know, we're left with the crumbs after everything else has sort of been sorted out by the power brokers, who are, you know, the 1% and the corporations who are really managing these situations to their own benefit and for their own profit motives in all three countries. But it's working people who are left with, you know, a really miserable situation. And that's the losing and the winning that we have to be attentive to.
All right, and I want to go through how those folks are losing here and in Mexico.
Us folks, right?
Yes,
unless
indeed.
You're a billionaire, it's us folks.
I'd like to try and keep it on the down low, but one of the ways that certainly Mexicans are losing is a function of what you were talking about in terms of the corn, which I think is fascinating. So the idea of this comparative advantage suggests that if something's called corn in the United States, it's the same thing as corn in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not. And the nature of our corn, when used in the way that Mexicans use corn, is, I mean, it's like, it's almost like poison. Right. I mean,
Okay.
Walk us through that, because this dynamic, I think, is fascinating because, you know, the idea is like, what difference does it make?
Exactly.
In addition to the fact that what we're doing in terms of displacement of people in rural areas in Mexico, I want to talk about that. But let's just talk about the cultural use of corn as a food product when it comes from the United States, it's not the same corn, and that means something.
Right. So I think about 95% of the corn grown in the United States is one of two varieties that have been engineered to be very high starch and sugar content. They have less fiber, less protein than heirloom races of corn. And they have been basically cultivated over time to engineered over time to produce characteristics that are favorable to industrial uses. So virtually all of that corn doesn't get eaten in any way that we think of as corn, right? When we think of, you know, sweet corn that we eat in August, you know, with butter and salt on it at a, you know, a picnic or a barbecue, that corn is not what we're talking about when we talk about corn in the United States. That's a tiny little infinitesimal fraction of the corn cultivation in the United States. But the vast majority of it, we never see as corn. It's industrial corn that's going straight into corn syrups, corn starches, corn fillers, cornmeal, and
almost every product on the shelf in your supermarket, you pull down and you will see some. It will either explicitly say cornstarch or it will be some other ingredient that you cannot pronounce that is based upon corn in some way. I'm virtually everything
exactly.
That's in a box and not in saran wrap, essentially, in your supermarket probably has this, unless it explicitly is trying to sell itself as without corn.
I think even McDonald's chicken nuggets have more corn than chicken. You know, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. If you take, you know, you pull out a hair from the average American's head and test it, you know, we're people of the corn far more than anybody else historically. We are corn. It's in everything we eat. And I have a list that I, you know, cite from another source in my book, and one of the footnotes, I think it's 45 different terms of chemicals and product ingredients that go by other names, maltose, dextrose,
right.
All of the, you know, all of the different ways, guises that corn might be hiding in industrialized food products. And ethanol, right? It gets used for ethanol. It gets used for all kinds of industrial
purposes. And factory
purposes.
Farming of meat, essentially.
Of meat, yeah. Which, by the way, I mean, I'm not providing any new information on this, but, you know, we can look at Michael Pollan's work, you know, in terms of how, you know, cows are not meant to eat corn. And so if you feed them a diet based on corn, you have to give them antibiotics and other things to enable them to digest it because they're grass feeders.
So
anyway,
there's
a whole bunch of issues.
Right. There's a lot of issues that are problematic about our corn policy in this country. It was the early 70s when we decided we want consumers to have more spending power. And one of the ways that we did that is our government began to subsidize corn heavily because it would make food products
cheaper
and a smaller portion of our disposable income would go towards food. And then theoretically we would buy more products, et cetera, et cetera. That's a first order problem for the United States. It's a second order problem for Mexico, because when this corn gets to Mexico, they don't use it as filler in their products. They don't use it as a sugar substitute. They don't use it to feed their cattle. They use it in the way that they have always used corn, which is very different than the way we do. And
well,
talk
they
about
do.
That.
They do both, right? So when U.S. corn, because we have so much of it, we try to get everybody else to use it too, right? So Mexico, since NAFTA, has vastly increased its consumption of processed foods and vastly increased its consumption of soda, of livestock, of meat. And so all of these things are things that are built on that cheap corn, all of the offshoot industries that have transformed the Mexican diet. And so the way that the average Mexican eats is much more similar today because of NAFTA to the standard American diet than it ever was before NAFTA. So that is, they are eating it the way that we eat it as well. But they also have a tradition of having a corn-based diet, the milpa-based diet. The milpa is a cornfield where you have intercropped corn, beans, and squash, which goes back, you know, thousands of years in the region. And their tortillas, which are the staple food in the Mexican diet historically, tamales, tlacoyos, I could go on and on and on, all the things that Mexicans jokingly call vitamina T, vitamin T, all the word, the wonderful words that start with T, including tacos. The corn-based diet is based on heirloom varieties of corn, which are incredibly nutritious. When they're combined with beans, they're a perfect protein. You actually don't need any animal protein apart from that. Although people did eat animal protein, but generally a much smaller quantity than they do today. And they grind it. They nixtamalize it, which is a wonderful way of infusing it with mineral lime, which releases and makes bioavailable the niacin, the vitamin B, that makes corn so nutritious and prevents pellagra and other deficiencies that we see when corn is eaten without that sort of processing, that release of the vitamins and nutrients. And they, you know, have a marvelous variety of uses for the corn. What we're seeing now, which is really tragic, it was scandalous a couple of weeks ago, there was a revelation that a lot of the tortillas that are being eaten in Mexico are coming from maseca, which is dried corn flour that comes in a sack that you can get it at the supermarket. You can get it in any U.S. supermarket these days, as well as every supermarket in Mexico. And Mexico has tortillerias, which are fresh tortilla factories that are also frequently now using this dried bagged commercial corn flour. That commercial corn flour is still supposed to be produced from Mexican corn because the Mexican government has prohibited GMO corn. It has prohibited Monsanto from testing its GMO corn in the Mexican environment. But guess what? Maseca is full of glyphosate. It's full of GMO corn. And so this is a sign that either Mexicans are being fed corn that was never intended to be eaten in the form of tortillas, and so the corporations are passing off U.S. corn as Mexican corn, or there's corn being grown in Mexico that's being purchased from Monsanto. So either way, this is a problem. It's a problem for health. It's a problem for the economy. It's a problem for small corn growers. And we're seeing, you know, all of the array of health problems that stem from this kind of industrialized food diet, all the non-communicable diseases. The diabetes has become the number one killer in Mexico since NAFTA. We've seen this explosion of health issues.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that, because the implications of this are obviously on people's health, on public policy, on the expenditures of the government. I mean, it has a ripple effect, and it is, I mean, how big of a change is it on the culture of Mexico and on the life of Mexico and just sort of just Mexican society? I mean, I think, yeah, it's easy for people to sort of, you know, well, okay, there's a higher rate of diabetes. You know, it happens. I mean, I think, like,
right,
like, I mean, just what kind of impact does this have?
Well, it's a whole array of issues. So one is the disruption in the countryside, which has displaced so many people. So a lot of people are no longer living in the places or in the communities that they grew up in. And there's a very strong link between trauma and violence and diabetes. And so as many as 10% of the Mexican population moved to the United States after NAFTA, right? So when we hear, you know, the president and other people talking about an immigration issue, it's an issue that was produced by U.S. policy because it displaced so many people from the countryside. So you have people living in new environments, eating in new ways, experiencing trauma that makes the body, you know, changes the way the body metabolizes sugar. And then you have a completely transformed food environment in which, you know, Mexico is now number one consumer in the world of instant noodles. People can't afford, both in terms of time and money, they can't afford to eat their traditional foods, which are labor intensive, which require access to fresh ingredients. And so people are eating ramen noodles and they're having a Coke, a liter of Coke while they work because it provides sugar and caffeine to get you through the workday when you don't have time or money to eat a proper meal. And the consequences are severe because diabetes, so it's number one killer. But, you know, when we think about diabetes in the United States, we often think about it as, you know, something that nobody wants to have, but it's a pretty manageable thing. For most people, it gets addressed early and it can be dealt with over decades. In Mexico, it tends to be diagnosed much later and it tends much more often to be fatal. So people are, you know, being diagnosed at a stage when they can no longer reverse the effects through, you know, either diet and exercise or insulin treatment. And so we see, you know, this incredible death toll, which is actually, you know, bigger each year than the entire drug war put together.
Wow.
And, you know, we have a lot of information about that, right? There are Netflix series and there are, you know, scandalous news reports every day of the week about drug violence, but we don't hear about this slow death of diabetes that's claiming many more lives.
Let's talk about that, the second aspect, or at least in terms of like that dynamic between the free flow of capital, which we, you know, we clearly have here, right? And these theories coming out of these neoliberal policies coming out of the University of Chicago, libertarian policies that are quite similar in terms of globalism that came out of Mont Pelerin, and it was Quinn Slobodian who had written a book, The End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism, that talked about at least this agenda in theory, right? And NAFTA is it in practice. And so what would it look like if, I mean, how is the idea, because the book essentially says the idea of NAFTA, the problem is not that we shouldn't have a relationship, a trade relationship with Mexico. The problem is this is a relationship that benefits only one class of people. And so how would it be different and if it was a trade agreement that benefited all the classes of people, or at the very least, maybe it excluded the capital, you know, these billionaires, all due respect to our large billionaire contingent that listens to the program. But I mean, what would it look like and what would be the different dynamics in terms of immigration and in terms of, I mean, what, give us a sense of what it would look like if properly done and what maybe the broad policy strokes would be to get there.
Right. Well, Sam, I don't know. Did you get your invitation to the trade talks? Because mine seems to have gotten lost in the mail. I don't think that we were invited to sit down at this table. We were not part of the discussion. And I think that, you know, when I say we, I mean everybody, right? Like all of us who are impacted by these deals, but we're not at the table. Who is at the table? Trade deals are negotiated under what's called fast track authority, which is basically when Congress thinks that something's going to be too sticky to get through our democratic channels the normal way, they send it behind closed doors. They have, you know, negotiators who are deputized to work on behalf of the U.S. government. They hammer out a deal, and then they come back and tell us what the deal is, and our congressional representatives have the option to vote it up or down. Oftentimes, the deal itself is pretty much a black box, right? We already know that Congress people don't always read the bills that are not being negotiated behind closed doors. But these are really giant deals with a lot of complexity, and everybody just kind of lets the trade negotiators who've been, you know, deputized to do this for us sit down at the table and work it out for us. There are a lot of really scary things in this deal. in the original NAFTA, but also in the newly revised version of NAFTA. So one of the things is these trade arbitration courts that are sort of a supranational realm where
these
you know,
are the investor
like
dispute resolution agreements.
They can sue Mexico or the United States. They have kind of power to sue governments for not adhering to the rules of trade just for protecting their own people. So Mexico can actually be found liable for violating the terms of NAFTA because it wants to, for example, keep GMO corn out of its economy, or it wants to protect its local corn growers. These are things that are very problematic for our idea of democracy, and we're not being consulted. So if the corporations, by the way, in theory, are also not at the table, but we already know that there's a revolving door between a lot of agencies in Washington and the corporate sector to begin with. So we can't imagine that there's really a firewall between corporate interests and government negotiators anyway. But they have other ways. They have, billion-dollar marketing budgets.
Without a doubt.
And
under Obama, it was a former Citibank employee who, Citigroup, Froman. And, I mean, their industry, and they are getting, under TPP anyways, they were getting a lot of the heads up on what was being negotiated. But putting aside the dispute resolution thing, which essentially strips countries of their sovereignty, penalizes, and it also can penalize states too. If a specific state wants to protect, state EPA wants to pass
California.
A law. They've got to
almond growers or whatever.
They could theoretically end up having to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to just simply exercise the will of the people through their own government, or they will not do it because they don't want to get involved in lawsuits. But getting to the other parts that are sort of structural, like what would it look like in terms of people? What would the people element of this be in how it implicates immigration?
Well, one of the things that we would want to think about, is why did we leave people off of the table, right? I mean, we've got, tear gas being sprayed at babies on Sunday at the U.S.-Mexico border. That border, why do we feel such a need to wall off our trading partner? What if we didn't militarize that border? And instead of just letting goods and capital flow, we actually allowed people legally to go where the jobs are. That would be one thing to consider. It would solve a lot of issues. Another thing to consider would be what would it look like if our food system had food at its heart and not industrial commodities at its heart, right? So instead of thinking about how much, industrial corn and soy we can grow, what if fruits and vegetables were given priority? What if we, if we were going to subsidize things, why not subsidize things that are actually good for us, that are expensive? Fruit shouldn't be a luxury item when we go to the supermarket. It shouldn't be, I'm going to splurge today on a pound of grapes. But that's the situation that we're in today. And, our health and our well-being are being put secondary to corporate interests. So if we actually had people at the table who said, well, these are the ripple effects, this is what this is going to mean in terms of diet-related illness over the long run if people don't have access to fruits and vegetables and they're being, inundated and buried by this avalanche of processed foods. We might have a very different approach to trade and just the idea of progress and prosperity. It would look very, very different.
So is that concept of comparative advantage, is that even salvageable? Because it occurs to me that there's just too many things are too integrated in many ways. I mean, there's two issues with it, right? One is too many things are too integrated in too many ways into a society. If it's a significant portion, as measured by a significant portion of the economy, or even just in terms of people's daily life, if there was some other metric to measure that. A and B, that also raises some issues in terms of the security, food security. I mean, you see it maybe it's more obvious.
Look at the romaine.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I mean, we're so susceptible. We're so compartmentalized. We have, you know, such a small handful of producers, giant behemoth corporate monsters that are controlling our entire food system. That if there's one problem, it ripples out and it can make millions of us vulnerable. You know, nobody had Caesar salad for the last week because, right. You know, there was E. coli in our food system, and it's so complicated and so big that, you know, it's not like you can isolate, okay, that's the romaine that needs to be destroyed because it might have been contaminated. We have to assume that the entire system is contaminated because it's so giant. It's such an integrated system. That's a problem. Monocultures are a problem. We shouldn't be growing so much corn in the United States. We should be having a more biodiverse agricultural system where we're producing more things than just commodity corn coming out of our ears. So, you know, there are environmental issues, health issues, economic reasons, and cultural reasons why, you know, Mexico should still grow corn. We should be growing a multitude of crops in a multitude of ways to protect ourselves from climate change, from, you know, if there's some superbug that comes through that gets around the Roundup, think about, you know, the famine that could Right. result because we're all depending on these monocrops. So we need a system that's more balanced. You know, I don't want to get rid of global trade. I live in the Northeast. I would be eating apples and potatoes 9 months a year. I like having avocados. But how can we strive for a system that is a recognition of our codependence, of the diversity of our palates and of our societies, right, where we have access to a variety of products, but we don't have a system that's so precarious and that's so razor-focused only on corporate profits.
All right, lastly, Alicia, if I could just ask you, Jamie just came back from Chiapas and saw a caravan of internally displaced people. Nearly 1,000 or so, maybe a little more.
More than 1,000.
And what is your sense of when you see internally displaced, ostensibly coming from rural areas, ostensibly by you know, paramilitary groups, probably
yep.
doing the bidding of the government / corporate patrons? What I mean, where does that fit into this?
Yeah, it's all interrelated. The security issues, you know, Mexico has had to somewhat perversely modify, you know, its government's mission to suit this model of foreign direct investment and development, which really leaves a lot of things that a healthy society needs outside, and it leaves them, you know, it leaves them in the cold. You know, a healthy society needs a robust system of laws and legal accountability so that, you know, people who are, you know, taking those old cornfields in Michoacan and turning them to opium, you know, face consequences for doing that and the organized crime that's so rampant. You know, the new president coming in has said, you know, accountability and transparency in the legal system is the number one issue that he has to tackle. And everything is sort of radiating out from that. But a lot of it, you know, when we see in Central America, when we see the migrant caravans that are crossing borders and the caravans of people who are internally displaced, a lot of them are running from the worst wounds caused by this sort of neoliberal model of development that's making it impossible for people to stay. It's making it impossible for them to, you know, David Bacon has this, you know, the right to stay, the right to leave, the right to stay. And a lot of us, you know, in the United States who are worried about migrant rights, you know, are worried about how are we treating migrants and refugees. But we also have to think about, do people have the option of not migrating?
Right.
Can they stay where they are and, you know, have access to the basic necessities of life? And increasingly the answer is no, because of climate change and because of these, you know, these organized crime networks that are making life impossible in a lot of communities. And I think, you know, we have to really reconsider what we think, you know, in the book I'm writing a lot about food security, but I think it's security, right? Food is one aspect, but it's how we think about all of these things. And I think we've boiled down our notion of security to this really paranoid, narrow notion of like, protecting ourselves from terrorism, which, you know, there are other kinds of terrorism besides, you know, the way it's sort of conventionally defined. And that includes, you know, being unable to stay where you are.
Yep. And we also have to, of course, protect ourselves from the caravan. Alicia Galvez, the book is Eating NAFTA, Trade, Food Policies, and the Destruction of Mexico. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.